Good evening. Open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 5, please. That's where we'll begin tonight, Genesis 5. Thank you for being here tonight. This is one of those lessons that's different than a typical sermon. I hope that it will be edifying to you, kind of a companion lesson to yesterday morning's lesson on the scientific foreknowledge of the Bible. But we're glad that you're here, and we invite you to open up your Bibles to Genesis 5 as we begin our study. First of all, why does something like this matter? You know, the age of the earth. Why is that a topic that would concern Bible readers in the first place? Well, this matters because the credibility of the Bible is at stake. If the Bible describes a planet that is a few thousand years old, but there is scientific proof that the earth is 4.6 billion years old, then we have a problem, right? We've caught the Bible in a lie. If that's a scientific fact, then we've caught the Bible in a lie. So the Bible itself and its credibility is on the line. How old is the earth? What's the Bible have to say about that? A lot of Earth's history has been recorded by people, and we can figure that a little bit more out from archaeology and so forth. For example, if we go back from our present time to the time of Christ, about 2,000 years, give or take. And we count those years now. We're in the year 2014. And so we know that's about 2,000 years. Secular history can take us back a little further than that, maybe with not as much precision, but if you count from Christ back to the time of Abraham, about another 2,000 years. And then the question comes in after that. If we go into that ancient history, Abraham back to the very beginning where Adam was, how long was that? Here in Genesis chapter 5, we see the Bible recording for us these genealogies. And it lists some numbers here. Genesis 5 and verse 3 says that when Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness according to his image and named him Seth. So we have the number 130 years and then he became the father of Seth. If you look in verse 6, Seth lived 105 years and became the father of Enosh. Verse 9 says, Enosh lived 90 years, became the father of Kenan. And so on. And so you have these numbers that are listed there. If we put that together with the numbers we find in Genesis 11 and just add those up, it comes to 1,946. Again, about 2,000 years. So if we plug that back into the former slide, that gives us an age of about 6,000 years for the planet Earth. Somebody says, well, you know, these genealogies, father might mean ancestor, or maybe there's skipping a generation or two or something like that, and maybe in the middle ground here, this Christ back to Abraham, maybe some of those dates are not ironclad, and so we need to allow for some wiggle room there. I'm not trying to argue the precision here. Even if you double it, let's say 12,000 years old, still we're dealing with somewhere in the thousands, not the billions. Evolution needs millions and more likely billions of years, they say, if anything is going to evolve into the complex life that we see today. So it's close enough, but we can just say it's somewhere in the thousands, not the billions. So what about things that we hear in science then, about Earth being much older than that? That we can date rocks and we can prove that, you go to the Grand Canyon, we can prove that the Earth is older than 6,000 years, 12,000 years, however many thousand years. What about that? Well, I'm not a scientist, and I'm not standing before you with letters after my name giving me scientific credentials. All I can do is tell you some things that I've read and point you to some sources where you can go do some further reading and just do a little bit of exposing some of the true science I believe is out there so that our faith in the Bible is not shaken. Look in Romans chapter 1, please. Let's just make the assertion that science has not proven the earth to be billions of years old. Romans chapter 1 is not dealing specifically with our topic tonight. I just want to notice a principle that's used here. Romans 1 and verse 18 says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse." In other words, the principle he's using there is that you can look at creation and see evidence that tells you something about God, that this divine power exists. Now, you can't get specific information just by looking at creation. You have to go to the Word of God for that. But God expects us to be a thinking people, to be able to look at evidence and come to a proper conclusion from that evidence. So we want to do that tonight. Let's try to think. Let's try to come to the right conclusions about God and about what the Bible tells us about planet Earth and His Word and those sorts of things. So what's some of the evidence that's out there? Well, think about polystrate fossils, for example. Let's think about sedimentary rock layers. We look at places like the Grand Canyon. We see layer after layer of this sedimentary rock and all these different layers that are lined up on top of each other. And the common explanation that's often given is that these things were slowly laid down over time, maybe millimeter by millimeter. And so, I mean, you look at all these different layers, and that's your evidence for an old Earth, something that's taken millions of years to form. That's a uniformitarian approach, that each stratum is laid down millimeter by millimeter. But how would we explain these polystrate fossils then? Here's what one article says. It says, embedded in sedimentary rocks all over the globe are what are known as polystrate fossils. Polystrate means many layers and refers to fossils that cut through at least two sedimentary rock layers. Probably the most widely recognized of the polystrate fossils are tree trunks that extend vertically through two, three, or more sections of rock that supposedly were laid down in epochs covering millions of years. However, organic material, such as wood, that is exposed to the elements will rot, not fossilize. Thus, the entire length of these tree trunks must have been preserved quickly, which suggests that the rock layers surrounding them must have been deposited rapidly, possibly and likely during a single catastrophe like Noah's flood. Trees, reeds, catfish, whales, and other organisms with which the fossil record abounds and that exist as polystrate fossils did not die and lie around for hundreds, thousands, or millions of years while slowly being preserved. Truth be told, polystrate fossils testified loudly to a young Earth whose layers formed rapidly and not very long ago. Keep in mind that not everything that dies turns into a fossil. In fact, very little turns into a fossil. What happens to roadkill? The dog gets hit on the street out here, what happens to it? Between the ants and the buzzards and the weather and everything else, it's just going to turn to nothing, right? It's just going to rot, go away, get eaten, that sort of thing. So trees that die typically do the same thing. They rot, they decay, and they do not turn into fossils. But if something gets buried very quickly, it gets preserved and can turn into a mineralized rock or a fossil. And so a tree that goes through several layers of sediment is strong evidence that the layers were laid down very quickly, that tree was buried by that sediment quickly before it had a chance to rot. Wouldn't make sense for the bottom to be covered up and the rest up here to last for millions of years while millimeter by millimeter it finally got buried. Here's what one author says. There's no doubt that this type of fossil was formed relatively quickly. Otherwise, it would have decomposed while waiting for strata to slowly accumulate around it. And so the numerous polystrate fossils that have been found all over the world provide strong evidence that at least these fossils were buried rapidly, as in some catastrophe, and the strata did not take millions of years to form. And so the idea that this is a gradualistic operation, that this is a uniformitarian thing that happens, simply doesn't fit the evidence. Of course, not all scientists are willing to concede that. In the 1970s, they found a baleen whale that was at about a 60-degree angle, head up, tail down. A Dr. Olney said, the baleen whale simply stood on its tail for 100,000 years, its skeleton decomposing while the diatomaceous snow covered its frame millimeter by millimeter. I don't know. I'm no scientist. It sounds like a stretch to me that a whale is standing on its head or it's in some position like that, not decomposing for some reason. Remember back here in the book of Psalms, chapter 19 and verse 1. Again, this isn't about polystrate fossils, but we're looking at the principle in operation here. Psalm 19 and verse 1, the heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of His hands. The principle is you look at the physical universe and you learn something. And that's all we're trying to do. What does the evidence show? We can look at creation and we can understand something about the power of God. We can look at fossils and we can look at other relics of the past and learn something about the events of this planet. Christians do not need to run from true science. Science is our friend. Scientific fact will always validate the Bible truth. And so we're not afraid of true science. Think about circular reasoning in the geologic column. What about the fossils? I mean, don't we know how old that stuff is? Doesn't that prove, again, that the Earth is millions of years old? I mean, we just date it, and that's the proof. Well, think about how that dating works, the current method for determining the age of a rock, for example. And say you have a rock that's got a fossil in it, and so we want to date this. We want to know how old the rock is. But the scientist will assign a date to the rock based on the fossil. Well, how do you know how old the fossil is? Well, because that's where the fossil fits in our evolutionary time frame. We believe that it's 320 million years old, for example. We believe this fish existed in the evolutionary tree 320 million years ago. Therefore, that rock must be 320 million years old. If we find another fossil in that same rock, we say, well, that fossil must be 320 million years old. So you're dating that fossil by the rock, you're dating this rock by the fossil, which is based upon our evolutionary thinking, our guesses of where it fits in the timeline. That's circular reasoning. That just doesn't work. That's an illogical way to do that. And so we recognize that, and even evolutionists recognize that some and will admit that. Here's a famous evolutionist, Niles Eldridge. He says, paleontologists cannot operate this way. There is no way simply to look at a fossil and say how old it is unless you know the age of the rocks it comes from. And this poses something of a problem. If we date the rocks by their fossils, how can we then turn around and talk about patterns of evolutionary change through time in the fossil record? Another one said, Thomas S. Kemp, a circular argument arises, interpret the fossil record in terms of a particular theory of evolution, inspect the interpretation, and note that it confirms the theory. Well, it would, wouldn't it? Look in the book of Isaiah, chapter 44, please. Again, I'm no scientist, but I can see a problem with the process, that's an illogical process. It's circular reasoning. Isaiah, chapter 44, remember what he says? He's talking about this block of wood. In verse 16, Isaiah 44, 16, half of it he burns in the fire. Over this half he eats meat as he roasts a roast and is satisfied. He also warms himself and says, aha, I'm warm, I've seen the fire. But the rest of it he makes into a god, his graven image. He falls down before it and worships. He also prays to it and says, deliver me, for you are my God. Now, did that make sense? You take a block of wood, half of it, you cook your meal, the other half you ward, here's my God. That didn't make sense. Did that stop millions of people from doing that? No. Just because millions of people do something doesn't mean it makes sense. Just because millions of people would fall down and worship an image that they just made does not mean it was true or right or good or made sense. Just because millions of people accept evolution does not mean that it makes sense or it's true or right or good. We want to recognize that point. Talking about dating methods a little more, faulty dating methods. Radioisotope dating methods are supposedly used to supposedly tell us the age of some of these rocks. This particular method only works with rocks that have once been in a hot, molten state, like a volcanic rock. And the idea is we can tell when that rock formed, when it cooled down, and when it formed into a rock based upon these radioisotopes. So here's my simplistic understanding of this. These methods of dating are based on how long it takes for one radioactive element to decay into another radioactive element, from a parent isotope to a daughter isotope. So the example on the screen takes uranium-238 and goes down here to lead-206. Or there's potassium-40 to argon-40 and various different ones that they use. So you put that in a laboratory, you can measure. How long does it take uranium-238 to decay to lead-206? And they can measure and they know that rate of decay. And so if you find a rock, and part of it is uranium, part of it's already decayed into lead-206. The theory is that we can look at that and extrapolate backwards to tell when it was 100% the parent isotope, in this case uranium-238. But, you know, it sounds interesting. Critics point out that's based on a lot of assumptions, though. Here's four of them. The rate of decay has always been the same over time. That's what's assumed about it. It's also assumed that there have been no elements added to the rock over time. It's assumed that there have been no elements lost from the rock over time. It's assumed that the amount of daughter elements at the beginning of the process are known. Now, you don't know all of those things first. You can just go out and find a rock. You don't know what has happened to that rock down through the years. Now, if none of that makes sense, just forget it. The proof is in the results, right? Let me show you some of the results. And if that doesn't come out right, then you know something is wrong. Back here in Deuteronomy chapter 18, we're not talking about prophets here, but do you remember the test of a prophet? Deuteronomy chapter 18 and verse 21, he said, "You may say in your heart, how will we know the word which the Lord has not spoken? When a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, if the thing does not come about or come true, that is the thing which the Lord has not spoken. The prophet has spoken it presumptuously. You shall not be afraid of him." So again, I'm not dealing with prophecy here, but think about that principle. If the outcome is clearly wrong, there's something wrong with your source. Now he says in this case, if the thing doesn't come to pass, you know the prophet is just wrong. He's speaking presumptuously. Okay, so let's talk about these dating methods. If we know we're getting the wrong answers, then that calls the dating methods into question, does it not? Think about the Grand Canyon, for example. If they date rocks that are on the top layer up here, from their own way of thinking, those should be younger rocks, ones that are on the higher layers of sediment. The lower layers down here ought to show older ages when they date them. And so when they run tests, you can see a number of different ones on the screen ranging from 0.01 million years old to some up to 2,600 million years old. So first of all, there's a huge range when they test the same rocks up there in the basaltic rocks of Yunkurit Plateau. When you go down deep, for example, to the Cardenas Basalt, the ages again range going from, 17 million years to 1,070 million years or 1.07 billion years. We'll put those on there. So again, big ranges there, but on average, the ones that are supposed to be younger on the top are averaging older than the ones that are deep down underneath. Something's wrong then, right, with those dating methods, if that's the results that you're getting that are opposite of what they should be. Also, in places where it's known how old the rocks are, the numbers are coming out wrong. Here's three examples. The first one, Sunset Crater in northern Arizona. A volcanic lava erupted about 900 years ago, but the potassium-argon dating method gave ages of 210,000 and 230,000 years. We know the rock's 900 years old. Something's wrong, right? Lava rocks from the Kwapalehu Flow Hualalai volcano, if that's how you pronounce it, which erupted in 1800 to 1801, were dated by several radioisotope methods. The results included 12 different dates ranging from 140 million years to 2.96 billion years, with an average date of 1.41 billion years. So we know they're 200 years old. Look how they're testing. Something's wrong here. The results aren't coming out right. Mount St. Helens. A lot of people in this room were alive when Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980, May 18th. And when they date those rocks, they waited for the lava to cool, then they date those rocks. They should either be too young to test, maybe there's an error, not enough daughter elements there to test. Here's what they say. Samples gathered have now been dated using the potassium-argon method. According to radioisotope dating, certain minerals in the lava dome are up to 2.4 million years old. All of the minerals combined yield the date of 350,000 years by the potassium-argon technique. However, we know that these minerals and rocks that contain them cooled within lava between the years 1980 and 1986. Hey, if you're getting the wrong results when you know how old they are, something's wrong with the dating methods, right? That's radioisotope dating. You heard a lot about carbon-14 as well. Carbon-14 is a little bit different kind of testing. It's used on things that were once alive, like plants and animals. And it's measuring how much carbon is left in those things, like in the bone or in the tree or whatever it is. And it's trying to calculate backwards. If this much carbon is left, calculate backwards. This is when the thing must have died and started to decay and so forth. Again, notice these published dates. See how unreliable carbon 14 dating is. They dated a mollusk, kind of like a little snail. It was still alive. The carbon 14 date of death was about 3,000 years ago. Still alive. It should be a number of zero, I guess. Some freshly killed seals have been dated at 1,300 years old. There was a musk ox that was found frozen in Alaska. The scalp of that animal was dated to 24,000 years ago. Some hairs from the hind limb dated to 7,200 years. Same musk ox. I don't know how old it was. It was just found frozen in Alaska. Same animal in a wide range in the years given. Some wood taken from some trees that were still actively growing has been dated by the C14 method as being 10,000 years old. Now again, I'm not a scientist. You don't have to be a scientist to see something's wrong. These dating methods are not ironclad. In fact, they're very unreliable. Well, let's think about Mount St. Helens a little bit more and something that they call catastrophism. On May 18, 1980, at 8:32 a.m., Mount St. Helens erupted. And many of you may remember that happening, seeing that on TV and so forth. Well, geologists all over the world, of course, knew it was going to happen. They had their instruments there. Everybody was recording this, and it was a great geologic event. It was measured and recorded as much as they could. The energy output from that eruption was equal to, over the next 9 hours, was equal to about 30,000 Hiroshima atomic bombs. And over the next days and weeks and years, the eruption taught geologists a whole lot about catastrophes and how they can affect things in a very significant way and make things happen very fast that prior to that, they thought took thousands or maybe millions of years to happen. In 2003, there was a book written called Footprints in the Ash. I've got my copy down here. But I loaned it to somebody and they left it out in the rain, so my pages are all falling out. Footprints in the Ash about this eruption, written by Drs. John Morris and Stephen A. Austin. Dr. Morris has a PhD in geological engineering. Dr. Austin has a PhD in sedimentary geology. So they've got the credentials that I don't have. And they explain in simple terms some of the findings from that eruption. And as significant as that eruption was, as powerful as Mount St. Helens was, it was actually small, they say, as far as volcanoes go. The last explosion at Yellowstone was 2,000 times as powerful as Mount St. Helens was. But if Mount St. Helens could cause such geologic change, what could a global flood do? Can you imagine that? Listen to some of the things that they say. Let me read some excerpts from their book and a few other quotes mixed in. You might remember, just from looking at pictures and news coverage, that the mountain kind of just blew up. The whole side of that mountain just blew up, and they had that, these huge landslides coming off of there. 3.3 billion cubic yards of rock and ice and debris came shooting off of there, going up to 150 miles an hour. Then when it got down there, of course, that snow and ice melted, and so they had these huge mud flows that go up to 90 miles an hour. They knocked out a bunch of bridges. They plugged up rivers. It was this huge, huge catastrophe in that area. All the vegetation was scraped away by all of those flows. So it's not just the lava causing change. It's this avalanche of debris and also then the ice melting and these huge mud flows that they had at that time. They came to Spirit Lake, which is a few miles away from Mount St. Helens. And at first, observers thought that Spirit Lake had disappeared. And then upon closer inspection, they found it's just about a million logs on the surface floating. And so it looked like all the water was gone. And so here's a picture before the eruption, all the lush vegetation, and then after the eruption, all that's just completely scraped off of there and became part of that avalanche and going to places like Spirit Lake. Here's some perspective. There's a little guy, you can't see him, in a little boat down there on Spirit Lake. Creationists suggest that during Noah's flood, log mats like this may have yielded a deposit of broken plant debris called peat, the precursor to coal. So, of course, you have all these geologists all around the world looking at this and studying this, and they start noticing, this might be how some coal formed on our planet. Given the great amount of coal which is mined out of the earth, geologists have wondered for a long time, how did all that get down there? What were the conditions that would bring something like that about? And so you think about the way that's formed, and I don't understand all of the special conditions that have to be in place, but creationists have speculated that coal may have been formed as a result of Noah's flood, during which massive amounts of vegetation were scraped from the continents. During the flood year, abundant volcanic action produced clays which mixed in with peat. Subsequent deep burial by oceanic muds would have applied the pressure and heat needed to alter them rapidly into coal. A cycle of such decay, decomposition, and metamorphism produced the multiple layers of coal that we see in the geologic record. Unfortunately, no such floating mat existed for creationists to study until Mount St. Helens erupted, that is. We've been studying it ever since. They say, by the way, another eruption of Mount St. Helens might someday bury this peat under a hot layer of lava or volcanic ash. If it did, all of the requirements for rapid coalification would be present. A fellow named Dr. Marion Fox, who's a professor of electronic engineering technology and math and physics, he wrote a book entitled A Study of the Biblical Flood, and he agreed that the flood is a good explanation for the coal found in the earth today. This is what he said. This weight, any means of the floodwaters upon the earth, of several million pounds per square foot would form coal from the plants and the sediment below the water. He goes on to say that these pressures could bring about the formation of petroleum and natural gas in a matter of days instead of years. So here's just one aspect. They're looking at Mount St. Helens and some of the effects that it have to see kind of in microcosm maybe what happened as a result of the flood and some of the things that that might have caused. Some of you in here, I think, have been to Yellowstone. I never have been there, but they have this petrified forest there. One of the supposed proofs of an old earth is this petrified forest there in Yellowstone. It's been said to take tens of thousands of years for this thing to form. There's a series of 27 layers, each containing beautiful petrified trees in both upright and horizontal positions. They lie exposed by erosion at Specimen Ridge. Over 50 such layers are found at nearby Specimen Creek. And so Specimen Ridge has been used as a strong argument for an old earth because it looked like, you know, forests, successive forests that have taken, who knows, tens of thousands of years to form there. How could you have this many? Here's a forest, and then lots of time passes, thousands of years, that one gets covered up, another forest on top of that, and so forth. So it looked like a lot of geologic activity over a long period of time. But then you had Mount St. Helens, and you had all these logs floating on Spirit Lake, and all the geologists are there, and they're looking at this, and they're just watching for the next few years the things that are happening. So over a million logs floating, and those present another scenario that could explain things like Specimen Ridge. Between 1980 and 2000, more than 500,000 of those logs sank to the bottom of Spirit Lake, which is still actively receiving sediment. By 1985, about 20,000 of those logs had sunk and been buried, roots down in the sediment. Interestingly, they say different trees sank at different times, like the noble fir and the silver fir sank first for some reason. The Douglas fir would stay up floating longer. And so you had certain kinds of trees sinking first and getting buried and covered up by a little bit of sediment before other kinds of trees were sinking. Many of the trees are visible due to the Army Corps of Engineers draining Spirit Lake by 25 feet. So you can see the tops of those trees sticking up out of the water after that. And so they're imagining this scenario. Consider if Spirit Lake were completely drained and then geologists found these trees in this condition. The scene might be interpreted as a series of successive standing forests, each with a dominant species of tree, and each buried by separate volcanic events many years apart. It might even be concluded that the entire series took over tens of thousands of years to develop, but that would be incorrect. Actually, all those trees within the same time period. They all came from a few miles that way. They were an avalanche brought them over here, dumped them in the lake, and they were sinking and being buried at different times, and that's what happened. A catastrophe, catastrophism. There's also ample evidence that petrification need not take very long. Hot water rich in dissolved minerals like silica is found in some springs at Yellowstone has petrified a block of wood in only a year. So what about Specimen Ridge at Yellowstone? Is that proof of an old earth? In their book, Drs. Morris and Austin say this, "Visitors to the Yellowstone petrified forest in years past were greeted by an interpretive marker explaining a multi-thousand-year scenario. When confronted with the evidence from Mount St. Helens, the interpreters removed the sign at Specimen Ridge and changed the sign at another upright petrified tree stump location to indicate that the trunk had been relocated by moving muds similar to those at Mount St. Helens. It seems that one of the standard proofs that the Bible could not be trusted was itself in error, and the Bible still stands. Look back in Genesis chapter 7, please. If this is what could happen at Mount St. Helens, relatively small event. Genesis chapter 7, think about this. Verse 11, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on the same day, all the fountains of the great deep burst open. You talk about some geologic activity. And the floodgates of the sky were opened. The rain fell upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. Verse 17 says, and the flood came upon the earth for 40 days, and the water increased and lifted up the ark so that it rose above the earth. The water prevailed and increased greatly upon the earth, and the ark floated on the surface of the water. The water prevailed more and more upon the earth so that all the high mountains everywhere under the heavens were covered. The water prevailed 15 cubits higher, and the mountains were covered. All flesh that moved on the earth perished, birds and cattle and beasts and every swarming thing that swarms upon the earth and all mankind and all that was on the dry land and in whose nostrils was the breath of the Spirit of life died. Now again, if Mount St. Helens could do all this geologic change, what about the flood? How much do you think that accomplished? We look at the fossil record. We look at the Grand Canyon, things like that. Just think about that. Look over here in 2 Peter chapter 3. Notice the warning that Peter gave. 2 Peter 3 and in verse 3, he said, know this first of all, that in the last days mockers will come with their mocking, following after their own lusts and saying, where is the promise of His coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation. For when they maintain this, it escapes their notice that by the word of God the heavens existed long ago and the earth was formed out of water and by water, through which the world at that time was destroyed, being flooded with water. Peter warned, people are going to forget about the flood. Life's always been the same since the beginning of creation. Don't forget about the flood. Geologists, don't forget about the flood. Isn't it possible that much of what we see is the result of catastrophes in the past, like Mount St. Helens, and the biggest of those would have been the flood of Noah's time? In their book, and I recommend you pick up a copy of this, you can read it in one sitting, it's kind of in simplified terms, real neat. They list five evidences of this catastrophism that we learn from Mount St. Helens, and here they are. Number one, quickly formed stratification. They say glowing rivers of volcanic ash moved at speeds up to 100 miles per hour. Thin layered strata were deposited. These resemble strata which might be supposed to require many thousands or even millions of years to form. I don't know if you can see that too well. There's three different textures or layers there shown. The first one, all of these were laid down within just hours or days. And so the first one, this was the afternoon of the eruption. By the way, this is the top 60 feet of a 600-foot deposit. So this airfall tephra laid that afternoon. About a month later, a pyroclastic flow deposit. And then about 2 years later, another mud flow deposit on top. Geologists are watching that. They're seeing it being laid down rapidly. And where formerly it was hard to prove that that could have happened like that, that it didn't take millions of years to form. The Tapiates sandstone of the Grand Canyon, similar in many respects to deposits at Mount St. Helens, has traditionally been interpreted as taking long ages to accumulate on the floor of a calm ocean. The Tapiates is now understood to be the result of a series of dynamic underwater currents. Conventional geologists believe that it formed some 550 million years ago. Flood geologists, on the other hand, suspect that the Tapiates was one of the early deposits of Noah's flood. Catastrophic deposits covering a large region are common in the geologic record. Biblical catastrophism would predict exactly that. More evidence of catastrophe. Secondly, rapidly eroded canyons. Canyons were eroded through solid rock. A new system of canyons forms the upper drainage basin of the North Fork of the Tuttle River. It might seem that slow erosion formed these during countless thousands of years. So under normal circumstances, under uniform conditions, it would take a long time for a little stream of water to cut through solid rock, right? And yet they see Mount St. Helens, those canyons can form very rapidly, even through that hard basaltic rock. But that's the sort of thing that happened quickly on that occasion. Number three, upright deposited logs in Spirit Lake, like we've already talked about. Tens of thousands of logs eroded from slopes around Spirit Lake have been replanted in standing position in the bottom of the lake. These might seem to be a succession of forest grown during many thousands of years. We've talked also about the fourth one, rapidly formed peat layer in Spirit Lake. Sheets of conifer bark have accumulated in the lake as layered, coarse, textured peat. The deposit has significant similarity to the composition and texture of coal. Coal is usually assumed to be slowly formed swamp deposit. And number five, quick recovery of the ecosystem in the blast zone. Living things survived in the most severely devastated areas and are flourishing in the adverse conditions. The extraordinary response of living things to catastrophe has caused textbooks on ecosystem recovery to be rewritten. All this is pretty interesting. Again, I'm no geologist, but I think it's pretty convincing that catastrophes like volcanoes, tsunamis, tornadoes, earthquakes, avalanches, and certainly a global flood could explain what geologists discover today about our planet. Maybe it wasn't uniform. Maybe it wasn't a gradual process that made this planet look the way that it does today. Maybe there was something besides that small river at the bottom of the Grand Canyon that formed the Grand Canyon. Turn your Bibles back to Genesis again, please. This time, chapter 1. Also consider the idea of apparent age. Genesis chapter 1 and verse 11 said, "Then God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees on the earth bearing fruit after their kind with seed in them. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed after their kind, and trees bearing fruit with seed in them after their kind. And God saw that it was good. There was evening and there was morning, a third day." So here the Bible is describing trees. God creates trees. They're bearing fruit. How old were the trees? One day old, right? And yet they're mature trees bearing fruit. They appeared much older, and yet they weren't. That's the first day that they were created. How about verse 27? God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. How old were Adam and Eve when they were first created? Well, on that day, that's the first day they've been around, but they appear much older. Can't God create something that looks older than it is? Couldn't he have created the earth to look as old as he wanted it to? If he can create a full-grown adult, adults that are ready to be fruitful and multiply, they're not infants like we're used to seeing. John 2, Jesus creates that wine out of water. Usually that's a long process. Plant a seed, grow some grapes, mash them up, there's your wine. Didn't do that, right? He just created it. And so it appeared to be something that it was not. Here's another quote. Noah's flood totally restructured the surface of the earth and laid down, among other things, many layers of sediment full of the remains of dead plants and animals. The sediment soon hardened into rock and the organic material fossilized. We see those deposits now as sedimentary rocks and fossils. Elsewhere, we see great amounts of volcanic and metamorphic rock, far greater than could possibly form under today's conditions. These same rocks and fossils, when interpreted under the assumption of uniformity, are thought to provide evidence for evolution in the old earth. That interpretation wrongly includes the denial of both the flood and creation. Well, Mount St. Helens taught us a lot. We want to be thinking people. What's the evidence telling us about God and His Word? And they mention one other thing, dinosaur fossils with original tissue, something that's kind of been more recently in the news, something that you can keep an eye on to read more about. Scientists are finding dinosaur fossils with original tissue still in the fossils. So think about how fossils form. Let's say a dinosaur dies. Like we said earlier, it's just going to get eaten or rot or whatever. Unless it gets buried quickly and preserved somehow, and the conditions are just right, and then water can seep into that with minerals in it, and that mineralized water gets in the crevices and the little nooks and crannies of the bone, and that original bone just rots away over time, and what's left is mineral that hardens in the shape of that bone. And so there's your fossil. That's one way that a fossil is formed. But now scientists are sometimes opening up those fossils to discover that some of them have original tissue inside them. In other words, it's not just that hardened mineral. Well, here's the problem for scientists. That original material from the dinosaur itself should have decayed a long time ago. If dinosaurs went extinct 65 or 68 million years ago, there should be nothing left of that original organic material. So how can you explain its presence today in numerous fossils? One article put it this way: a completely different class of fossils holds remnants of animal biochemicals like proteins, pigments, and DNA that minerals never replaced, and lab tests indicate that these organic tissue components could not last a million years. Another article says, in recent decades, soft, squishy tissues have been discovered inside fossilized dinosaur bones. They seem so fresh that it appears as though the bodies were buried only a few thousand years ago. So, since many think of a fossil as having had the organic bone material replaced by minerals, the presence of actual bone, let alone pliable blood vessels, red blood cells, and proteins inside the bone, is quite extraordinary. These finds also present a dilemma. I first heard about this, actually, at a homeschool conference. This guy was giving a speech and mentioned this. It was on 60 Minutes, the CBS show 60 Minutes. This lady named Mary Schweitzer, a scientist, and also Jack Horner. And she put a fossil fragment in some acid to dissolve the outer layer of the mineral. But it worked too fast, and it dissolved all of the mineral, which meant there should have been nothing left in whatever container she was using there. But there was something left. This is the way CBS News puts it. This is what was left behind: things that look suspiciously like flexible, transparent blood vessels. She finally mustered the courage to tell Horner. She said she dissolved the bone away and there were blood vessels. And you know, I was like shocked, Horner remembered. How could that be? The things Schweitzer was finding inside dinosaur bones, blood vessels, and even what seemed to be intact cells pose a radical challenge to the existing rules of science, that organic material can't possibly survive even 1 million years, let alone 68 million. Pretty interesting. You can go on the 60 Minutes website, watch the video. She's got tweezers and she's pulling. You see the stuff up here? Kind of like, it says soft tissue there, and she's pulling it, and you can see it flexes as she's pulling it with the tweezer. Go to the video. I can send you the link. It's around the 9-minute, 40-second mark. They publish all this in the journal Science. Immediately, they come under attack. You're doing something wrong. You're looking at it wrong. Something's wrong here. Pretty interesting. I'm anxious to read more in the next few years about what the explanations will be. How is this material still there if these things died 68 million years ago? Look in the book of Job, chapter 40. I believe that humans and dinosaurs coexisted. I believe God created them all on those first 6 days, all living things, and that means that they would have coexisted on the earth. We have some interesting creatures mentioned over here. Job chapter 40 talks about the behemoth, verse 15. It says, "Behold now, behemoth, which I made as well as you, he eats grass like an ox. Behold now, his strength is in his loins and his power in the muscles of his belly. He bends his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze. His limbs are like bars of iron," and so forth. Verse 23, "If a river rages, he's not alarmed. He's confident, though the Jordan rushes to his mouth. Can anyone capture him when he is on watch? Can anyone pierce his nose?" Somebody said, "Well, that's just a hippo. That's not describing a dinosaur." Well, verse 17 says he bends his tail like a cedar. You ever seen a hippo tail? Not like a cedar. In the next chapter, chapter 41 in verse 1, "Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook or press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook?" Verse 7, "Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle. You will not do it again." Verse 13, "Who can strip off his outer armor? Who can come within his double mail?" Verse 25, "When he raises himself up, the mighty fear because of the crashing. They are bewildered. The sword that reaches him cannot avail, nor the spear, the dart, or the javelin. He regards iron as straw, bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones are turned into stubble for him. Clubs are regarded as stubble. He laughs at the rattling of the javelin. His underparts are like sharp potsherds. He spreads out like a threshing sledge on the mire." Your Bible probably has a footnote there on verse 1 that this is a crocodile. But people kill those all the time, don't they? This is something that the mighty fear. They're afraid of this thing. Can't attack this thing. You won't do it again if you try. But look at verse 19. Somebody said, yeah, but this is a mythological creature. Verse 19, out of his mouth go burning torches. Sparks of fire leap forth out of his nostrils. Smoke goes forth as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals and a flame goes forth from his mouth. That can't be real. Electric eels, 600 volts of electricity, don't shock themselves. Komodo dragon, mouth full of deadly bacteria, doesn't hurt him. Fireflies produce light. Bombardier beetles, two different chemicals stored in their bodies that come together when it's afraid. Chemical reaction shoots out this chemical burst, 212 degrees Fahrenheit. I believe God can make a creature that can breathe fire if He wants to. I don't know how He did it. Fumes coming out that get ignited somehow. I don't know what it was. I believe dinosaurs and humans coexisted. I believe God could make a dinosaur that breathed fire and could be described in this way. Somebody said, well, the word dinosaur is not used there, but that wasn't coined. The word dinosaur was not coined until 1842, so we wouldn't expect it to be in the Bible. What's our conclusion to all of this? Look at Exodus chapter 20 and verse 11. There is no need to reinterpret Genesis 1 and 2. People talk about the day-age theory, which I alluded to in the lesson this morning, that each of these 6 days of creation perhaps represents eons of time, and that allows us to fit in the millions or billions of years of time that evolution demands. Exodus 20 and verse 11, though, says simply, for in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that's in them. No reason to take that as anything but 6 literal 24-hour days. If it means eons of time, what did it mean in verses 9 and 10? 6 days you shall do your work, and the 7th day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. It's just talking about 6 regular days. No reason to take the gap theory, that there's a gap somewhere in the first 3 verses of Genesis chapter 1, and that's where we can fit in millions or billions of years. No reason to try to do that. Science has not proven the earth is billions of years old. Let's just take the text and have confidence that what God has given us is simply the truth. There's no reason to believe science has disproved the Bible. Nothing in the text itself that would make us think that. Nothing in true science that would make us think that. And so I hope your faith is not shaken when you hear these supposed scientific claims being made in the news and in colleges and things like that. Let's trust in the Word of God that He has provided to us. Now let's have faith. And when He tells us about His planet, He knows what He's talking about. And that also means when He tells us about our soul, He knows what He's talking about. Brethren, we need to think about the words that He's given to us, the plan of salvation delivered to us. This is our Creator. We must bow before Him in obedience. Come to Him, and He'll accept us in His mercy when we're repentant. If there's some way that we can help you this evening, please come forward while we stand and sing to encourage you.